From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The American criminal justice system is supposed to have built-in checks and balances, and the idea of due process and innocent until proven guilty are considered sacrosanct and uniquely American. But in practice, we've all heard of cases where defendants were wrongfully convicted or sentenced to unreasonably long terms because they couldn't afford an expensive lawyer. Now, an attorney who has served as a court-appointed lawyer has had a ringside seat to how criminal cases play out in our courts, and particularly on how judges display bias. She has become a whistleblower and just self-published a lengthy piece about her experiences and her analysis of our system. Zoe Dolan joins us for an exclusive. She is a lawyer based in New York and Los Angeles, focusing on federal criminal defense and representation in cryptocurrency and new technology projects. And her article on Medium is entitled Judges Run Amok, a defense lawyer's story of corruption and manipulation in the criminal justice system. Welcome to the program, Zoe.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, explain what exactly it is that the sort of legal framework within which courts appoint lawyers like yourself to those who either choose not to or cannot afford a private attorney, because this is an important part of the story.
The way that the Criminal Justice Act, which is the legislation from the 1960s that Congress passed to make this whole thing happen, works, is that in cases where there are conflict, where there's multiple defendants, and the community defender or the federal public defender cannot represent all those conflicted defendants, then they call in privately retained lawyers to represent those particular clients. We court-appointed lawyers are appointed pursuant to the Criminal Justice Act, and we do maintain our private practices. We also take these cases as a service to the court and as a service to the public.
Now, you're paid, of course, the same fees that a court-appointed lawyer would be paid, though, right, rather than what you might charge a private a client?
That's correct. It's really just a fraction of what I would charge a privately retained client. I might charge a privately retained client somewhere between $500 to $1,000 an hour for a federal criminal case, or a flat fee that would work out to be about that on an hourly basis. The Criminal Justice Act pays lawyers, it's currently $132 an hour, which may sound like a fairly significant amount, but one thing to remember is that includes all of a lawyer's overhead, all of a lawyer's expenses, and everything that goes into that lawyer's work on a particular case. And just by way of comparison, for example, when the Department of Justice hires outside counsel to represent former employees or current employees in civil or criminal or proceedings along those nature, they charge $200 an hour, so it's significantly less than what the Department of Justice pays.
And so for those people, those lawyers who take these cases, often they do so, like I understand yourself, because you have a conscience, you actually want to do something meaningful with the work that you do in representing those people who couldn't otherwise afford an expensive lawyer, because there's no other sort of financial incentive, right?
Right. The reason that I do this particular work is because I'm committed to the defense of the Constitution of our country and holding our government accountable, because I believe that that is important to not just the criminal justice system, but to the justice system as a whole, as well as everyone's individual rights. Because a lot of times, well, look, 90% of cases in federal court require the appointment of counsel because the client cannot afford to retain their own counsel.
That 90%? Wow.
It's approximately 90%. It might be slightly less, 88 or 89, but the most recent figure I've seen from the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers is approximately 90%. So what we have there is that a lot of law is being made in those cases when lawyers are filing motions, when lawyers are making arguments and setting the precedents that are then going to be relied on by any one of us if we ever end up in court for any reason whatsoever facing criminal charges. So it's important to remember when we're talking about indigent defense, we're actually talking about defense of the Constitution of the United States and all of the rights that we take for granted as American citizens.
And so you found through your experience and years of doing this that judges who are supposed to be the arbiters of these cases, they're supposed to be the most impartial figures. You found that they are quite biased in favor of prosecutions rather than defense. There shouldn't be a bias, but apparently there is. Explain that a little bit.
Well, there are all sorts of systemic issues that go into that problem. The federal rules of criminal procedure, the federal rules of evidence, just to begin with as a framework to think about these things, those are all written for the government's benefit and to secure convictions and to facilitate that process. The Constitution is what pushes back with our individual rights. So there is an inherent tension there that ultimately the judges, we depend on them to resolve. Issue really comes when one party, that's the defense, is put under the wing of the court, and the court not just appoints us, but is responsible for all of our payment vouchers and making decisions on whether the litigation that we pursue and the way that we handle cases is appropriate and whether they believe that it's something that they're going to pay for. And so we have a situation where very conceivably courts don't want to fund a defense that a lawyer might think is appropriate and necessary in a case. And then where are we left? We're left with a situation where that lawyer has to either go out of pocket on their own time or fight the court. And unfortunately, there's no real system of review for the voucher process. And so when courts make decisions, the lawyers are pretty much stuck with that. And so the end result of this process is that the judges, who, as you say, are supposed to be the impartial arbiters of justice, are in fact in control of the purse strings of the defense, which then puts them in control of the defense itself.
And do they compete for those funds for themselves as well?
Those funds are the way the current structure is, those funds are taken out of the same pot. So the judiciary are allotted a certain amount of funds per year. And from that amount, a certain amount within that amount is allotted to the defense. And it's split between the community defender organizations that I mentioned, as well as what are called panels of attorneys who are in private practice like myself and are appointed to these cases in the conflict situations.
And this seems to be a bit of a conflict of interest. And I'm wondering if some of the bias you've seen stems from that, from the funding issue.
Well, this is an issue that has been raised for decades. There was a study done by a review committee back in 1993, chaired by Judge Prado, whose first name is suddenly escaping me, Edward, I believe, Judge Edward Prado. And what the committee that he chaired found was that that precise aspect that you've just pinpointed was a potential problem, if not a real problem, even back then in 1993. And it's only worsened since then.
So you became a whistleblower, and you write about this in your piece on Medium. Tell us what you did, how you see yourself as a whistleblower, how you tried to call attention to this issue, and then what you faced.
Right. So the issues that I started to see were an increasing level of interference by the judiciary, particularly in the Central District of California in Los Angeles, which is the most populous district in the nation with approximately 19 million people. And what I saw was more and more of an encroachment, particularly, you know, from the aspect of a financial perspective, on how the court was becoming involved in what was appropriate for lawyers to do, what was not appropriate for lawyers to do, and whether they would ultimately pay for the defenses that lawyers thought were appropriate and necessary. Several years ago, there was controversy because a handful of lawyers were admittedly overbilling for their services. I don't know what was going on there. I wasn't a party to any of that. It was actually before my time in Los Angeles when I started practicing there in 2014. But the point of that is that the court then responded like, as I wrote in my Medium piece, a wrecking ball. And instead of conducting, some sort of targeted investigation, remedial measures to deal with that issue, they clamped down on absolutely everyone. And the end result of that was that the court became intimately involved in the minutiae of defending a case. Now, where in districts where there is a balance and the judiciary respect the independence of the defense function, the system can and does work at least as an interim solution until full independence for the defense is achieved. But what I saw was an increasing interference with the minutiae of a defense and an increasing amount of control that was exercised by the judiciary over the defense function as well as individual lawyers who were handling cases.
And how did that play out in terms of the decisions on cases? How did your clients get impacted by this?
So that's a very difficult and sensitive question to answer because no lawyer will say, oh, yeah, I worked less on a case, or I didn't do this motion because I knew that even though I thought it would be necessary and appropriate, the court wouldn't pay for it. No lawyer would say that. What I became concerned over was precisely that question, as I continued to practice in the district. Well, what about when I face that? And I just looked in the mirror and I asked myself, is this situation affecting how I think about my cases and how I approach my client's defense? And I realized that it was affecting how I approached my client's cases. And when I realized that, I said, this has to stop. And so I moved to dismiss for what are called mega cases. They're large scale, very multi-defendant cases, dozens and dozens of clients in them. And I said, look, I'm going to start with these cases because they're the most demanding from a time perspective as well as the attorney work involved. And I think that because of the institutional biases and failures, systemic failures to ensure equal justice, my clients' cases, I sought their dismissal because I said the court is not fair.
You think that there must be some sort of numbers to show that there's a bias. If 90% of those who are prosecuted in our courts are indigent, quote unquote, meaning they cannot afford their own lawyers, so a lawyer is appointed to them. Do we find that there are just far more convictions among those than there should be?
The figure that's usually bandied about is that indigent defendants who go to trial in federal court face an over 95% conviction rate, and sometimes it's 97 to 98%. I myself just got my most recent client fully acquitted in the Central District of California at a trial in August, but that doesn't happen very often. In federal court, however, one of the main concerns that we go into cases with, because a lot of times, to be frank, the government has been conducting a multi-year investigation and has a whole mountain of evidence. A lot of it is dealing with plea negotiations and mitigating sentencing exposure so that we arrive at the correct sentences in any particular case. And the reason that this is important is because Judge Gwynne, Gwyn, who sits in the District of Ohio, did a study. And he polled jurors in, I think, 20 or 22 juries in various cases in his district after the trial was done, what appropriate sentences for those clients should be. Now, the jury had just heard the trial and, didn't know anything about the defendant's background or any mitigating circumstances. And even then, Judge Gwynne found that on average, those jurors would have sentenced the sentence that they get, the sentence that the federal sentencing guidelines recommends in those cases was 4.5 times higher what the jurors would have sentenced to, 4.5 times what the community sentiment was. And
wow.
the reason that's
wow. a, I mean
and
that
the
sounds
reason,
punitive.
it's shocking. And the reason that this is a problem is because when we go back to the sentencing guidelines creation back in the 1980s, Congress directed the Sentencing Commission, which is charged with promulgating the guidelines, sentencing guidelines ranges and everything that goes into them, with taking community sentiment into account and basing sentences on community sentiment. But the Sentencing Commission didn't do that. Instead, what they did was they just surveyed 10,000 sentences. Well, those sentences were from federal judges. Federal judges are anything but reflective of the community. I think we can all agree on that. And so that's why we ultimately arrive at such a problem where for over three decades, the entire federal sentencing guidelines has been 4.5 times too high on average. And so when I say that it's important to have independence for the defense function, this is precisely the type of systemic problem that I think needs to be pushed back against. I mean, we have to pay over $31,000 per year per federal inmate for incarceration. And so my position is, at over $87 a day, no one should be in jail from a taxpayer's perspective, regardless of your political beliefs, one day longer than they really ought to be, let alone 4.5 times.
So yeah. We are in a country that incarcerates at a higher rate than perhaps any other country. We imprison way too many Americans, and in the federal, of course, the federal system is apart from the state prison system and state justice system. But do you feel that this sort of rampant bias and over sentencing really contributes to our over incarceration?
I think it's a social problem that we really need to start talking about, because the United States has 5% of the world's prison 5% of the world's total population, pardon me, but 25% of the world's prison population. That's unsustainable, both from a financial and economic perspective, as well as a human perspective. Other societies just don't do this. And yet they function and are highly advanced in many instances. And so I think, you know, that it's time for us to take a real look at what's going on here and how we're going to address it. And from my perspective, as I said, you know, when I looked around, I said, well, the most I can do here at this particular moment in time is to try to achieve independence for the defense function so that we can start to push back against this without worrying whether the judge who's presiding over any particular case is not going to like it and then not going to pay the lawyer for all the work that they've done.
So you tried to call attention to this, and from what I understand, your entreaties were met with silence.
Well, initially, I was terminated from the panel of lawyers in Los Angeles who were qualified and experienced enough to handle these cases. We go through a rigorous vetting process to serve on these panels. When I first started, incidentally, in 2014, there were about 113, 114, 115 lawyers. There are currently, when I last looked a week or two ago, 65. So there are some real problems there.
So it's a problem when lawyers are either pushed out or maybe leave in frustration. What it seems as though the fix doesn't have to be terribly complicated. How does one fix this, at least some aspect of this bias? Can, you know, going back to this issue of funding, if we were to change the law on the federal level for how judges are in control of the purse strings for defense lawyers, could this aspect of our criminal justice system be fixed pretty simply?
Well, I think the more important question is independence, and we can move to funding in a second, but
okay.
The more important question is independence, because look at what happened to me. The court terminated me, and I was doing my best to advocate for my client's constitutional rights. Now, they will probably tell you, oh, it's because I wasn't in compliance with this or that rule or regulation, but those were the very rules and regulations that my clients had challenged as unconstitutional. And of course, I said, look, if an appellate court says they're constitutional, I will ultimately comply. So I don't really buy their explanation for it. And I think that there was a serious element of retaliation in it. And, you know, a lot of lawyers, when I asked them, well, why did, you know, they kind of said, oh, this is great. What you're doing is absolutely fantastic. We totally support you. I said, well, in that case, why don't you join the motions? And the answer was they were afraid. What were they afraid of? Well, precisely what happened to me, which is that they would be terminated from the panel and would no longer be able to serve. Mm-hmm. So that's a very real chilling effect that I've seen. And so I think that before we get to the question of funding, the initial question is independence. I think we can all agree, and it hardly seems to me a radical proposition,
right,
that the defense should be independent from the court, just like the government is. I think we should all be able to agree on that. And in terms of funding, I don't think it's appropriate for a presiding judge to control the purse strings on the defense of a case, just like I don't think it would be appropriate for them to control the purse strings on the prosecution. And one way of doing that would just be to easily take it away from the judges. Various legislation has been proposed, but you can think of ideas like, well, tie a certain amount of funding percentage-wise to DOJ funding. So whatever the DOJ gets, the defense gets an appropriate portion.
Well, Zoe, I should also mention, by the way, that you have been a federal lawyer on a high-profile case that the New York Times covered. You're someone who's done this for a very long time. You've been an attorney for a very, very long time, and certainly not to be taken lightly. So I'm assuming that your story will hopefully get some more attention in the coming days and weeks. I want to thank you so much for the work that you've done and for joining us today.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
We'll post a link to Zoe Dolan's Medium article from our website later today. My guest has been Zoe Dolan, a lawyer based in New York and LA. She focuses on federal criminal defense and representation in cryptocurrency and new technology projects. And she's been joining us for an exclusive on her recent article on Medium entitled Judges Run Amok, a defense lawyer's story of corruption and manipulation in the criminal justice system. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.